En azil, prosim.
A prihajajo? Ja, jaz nisem še nobeni krivil, tako da ne morem reči, zakaj prihajajo.
Ja, odvisno od kod, ne? Eni iz ekonomskih, eni iz političnih, eni, ne vem, iz Angola, zato ko so jim starše pobili in so pol pobegnili, ker bi še njih.
In če bi čital, če bi bil to tak problem, da bi bilo 100 ali pa celo več, bi se sigurno o tem kaj vedel, ne pa, da samo vedel, res da to.
Slovenska filantropija je leta 2001, ko se je pokazala potreba potem skupaj z UNHCR-om in Centrom socialno delo sklenila dogovor.
Vsak zadnji ponedeljek v mesecu ob 8. zvečer na valovih Radija Študent prisluhnite oddaji En azil, prosim.
Pozdravljeni. En azil, prosim, je nocoj z vami s ponovno izostrenim fokusom na dogodke in spremembe na področju azila oziroma mednarodne zaščite migracij in s tem povezanimi variacijami spoštovanja človekovih pravic. Začenjamo s poročilom Human Rights Watch, ki je ob novem letu izdalo publikacijo World Report Events of 2009, globalen pregled njihovega dela lanskega leta. Human Rights Watch je ena izmed največjih neodvisnih organizacij posvečenih varstvu človekovih pravic. Kenneth Roth, direktor Human Rights Watch.
As we do each year, we've focused on certain global trends, that we've discerned from our on-the-ground research. And the one that really stood out to us is ironically a product of the greater pressure that the human rights movement is able to put on abusive governments. Through shaming, through diplomatic pressure, through economic pressure. And in a perverse tribute to the human rights movement, there has been a notable reaction, a counterattack by many of these abusive governments. And that's what we've tried to highlight today in the introduction to the World Report. Now, some of this counterattack uses traditional techniques. For example, in Russia, which really stood out this year because of the number of human rights activists murdered. Murder, of course, is an old-fashioned way of trying to silence the human rights movement, of trying to reduce the cost of committing human rights abuse. Obviously, in Russia, these are not committed overtly by government agents. They're always unidentified assailants. But the government bears responsibility for doing such a poor job in bringing these murderers to justice. Other, you know, long-standing techniques include simply having a closed society. And we highlight places like Eritrea, North Korea, Turkmenistan, places where there virtually is no civil society and it's impossible for human rights activists to do their work openly. Other societies are virtually closed. There's an embattled human rights movement, but it's very difficult for it to work. Places such as Burma, Iran, Saudi Arabia, or Somalia, simply because of the danger of the place. Certain countries such as China or Sudan simply shut down human rights groups. Others will detain or harass human rights activists. These include places like Cuba, Vietnam, Iran, Saudi Arabia, or Syria. Other countries use threats of violence to try to curtail human rights activities. Colombia and Sri Lanka are two that we highlight. Now, the techniques that I've just mentioned are not new. These have been going on for many, many years. But what we've noticed over the last year or two is an increasing resort to subtle techniques, more deniable techniques, to try to silence human rights groups. The country that probably was the forefront of this was Russia, which a few years ago enacted a new law to regulate NGOs. But rather than make it easier for NGOs to operate, this really burdened NGOs with a range of highly intrusive regulations, where NGOs spend a lot of their time just dealing with government bureaucrats. And those NGOs that try to enforce some form of accountability for the government or defend human rights standards face particular attention by the Russian government. The country that brought this to a new level this year was Ethiopia, where the government has enacted a new law on NGOs that prohibits any NGO that receives more than 10% of its funding from foreign sources to engage in any kind of human rights activity. And this has had the effect of virtually decimating the human rights community within Ethiopia because there is no domestic philanthropic tradition for human rights work. Other countries, you know, such as India, have long restricted external funding of human rights organizations. And indeed, even this year, a democracy like Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu, went around trying to cut off funding for Breaking the Silence, the very important human rights group composed of soldiers who had served in Gaza and who were reporting the war crimes that happened there. Another technique that has come to the fore this year has been the disbarment of lawyers. China, Iran, and Syria have all resorted to this technique over the last year. Another, you know, deniable technique is to file pretextual criminal charges against human rights activists. We've seen this in China again, but also in Uzbekistan, in Rwanda, where the favored tool is the new genocide ideology law, in Iran, of course, most recently. And a number of governments also use criminal libel lawsuits to try to prevent human rights groups from speaking out. And here again, we highlight Russia, Azerbaijan, Serbia, Morocco, and Indonesia, all of which have used criminal libel over the last year. Now, human rights defenders understand that there is a risky business, that there are inherently risks involved in doing this work. And most people I know in the movement are willing to adopt these risks. They understand that that's just part of what they do. But we do call on governments to recognize this counter-reaction, this reaction against the human rights movement, and to begin to stand up for the human rights defenders who really are on the front line of the global defense for human rights. Those governments who ostensibly support human rights in their foreign policy should be devoting special attention to defending the defenders, to protecting the people on the front line of the human rights movement.
V ameriškem talk showu je Obama ob prvem letu predsedovanja ocenil sam sebe z B+, to je s prav dobro oceno. Odlične si po lastnem mnenju ne zasluži zaradi še neizpeljane zdravstvene reforme. Kenneth Roth iz Human Rights Watch opozarja še na vrsto drugih nekonsistenc med obljubami in realizacijo.
To sum it up, I think it's fair to say that there has been a dramatic improvement in presidential rhetoric. But the real task facing President Obama is to translate that improved rhetoric into better policy and practice, a translation that to date remains significantly incomplete. For example, the president has given a series of quite impressive speeches around the world, with messages often very tailored to the local audience. But these speeches have not been translated into comparable shifts in the way that the United States treats the problems that the president has identified in his speech. So, for example, in Accra, he gave a speech very much repudiating the approach of Bill Clinton to Africa. You may all remember that Bill Clinton liked to promote the new African leaders, people like Meles Zenawi in Ethiopia or Paul Kagame in Rwanda. Leaders today that while still impressive in their intellect, are leading their nations in a highly repressive direction. They're going the wrong way. President Obama said what Africa needs is not strong leaders, but strong institutions, the rule of law, a free press, a vigorous civil society. He's absolutely right about that, but that important insight has not been followed by comparable sustained pressure on the likes of Meles or Kagame. Similarly, in Cairo, the president spoke about the importance of democracy. And unlike George Bush, who gave up on promoting democracy as soon as Hamas won in the Palestinian territories, or as soon as the Muslim Brotherhood did better than expected in Egypt, the president said he would, you know, implied that he would accept even a Muslim Brotherhood victory in Egypt if that was the product of a fair election. A great statement, but then you look at what has happened. There has been no visible pressure on Egypt, or for that matter, countries like Saudi Arabia, other allies in the region, to move in a more democratic direction. In Moscow, where, as I mentioned earlier, Russia has been harassing and constraining human rights NGOs, the president met with civil society leaders and waxed eloquently about the importance of civil society, explaining that the criticism from civil society makes Mr. Obama do his job better. Again, a very important statement, but one that has not been followed up by serious pressure on Russia to bring to justice those who have been killing human rights activists. In China, again, the president, you know, had important words in broad terms about the significance of human rights, but he undermined that message by refusing to meet with the Dalai Lama in advance of his visit. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton undermined the message when earlier in the year she made clear that human rights won't interfere with other U.S. interests in China. And the president, when given a softball question about the Great Chinese Firewall, one that was planted by his own ambassador, didn't give his, you know, tear down the firewall speech, but rather talked about different traditions and did a long-winded kind of soft approach to the problem. I should say that Hillary Clinton will have an opportunity to try to redeem this this week when she gives her own internet speech. And the real test there is whether she's going to stick at lofty principles or is she going to say something specific and critical about China's repression, its arrest of bloggers, its restrictions on the internet. We'll have to see. Now, probably the greatest difference between Obama and Bush has been in the area of counterterrorism. I think everybody knows that in the second full day in office, Obama, by executive order, insisted that the CIA abide by the military's interrogation rules, which have been quite good since the Abu Ghraib debacle. He also closed the secret CIA detention facilities where people had disappeared and were tortured. And he vowed to close Guantanamo within a year. So far, so good. But where he has fallen short is that on the question of torture, he has refused to investigate, let alone prosecute, the people who ordered torture or the people who wrote the legal memos purporting to justify torture. That leaves a very dangerous precedent of impunity. Because even though I think many of us are confident that President Obama will not resort to torture, one can't say the same about some future president if the legacy of the Bush years is that you can commit torture and get away with it. Similarly, with respect to Guantanamo, it turns out that when President Obama said he would close Guantanamo, it seems that all he had in mind was the physical facility, not the symbol of Guantanamo. And what Guantanamo symbols to most of the world is the use of military commissions, substandard justice to railroad people to conviction, and the detention of people for long periods of time without charge or trial. And unfortunately, President Obama has not been willing to repudiate either of those two techniques. With respect to the military commissions, there is a new and improved version that Congress has now sanctioned, which does get away from the worst aspect of the Bush military commissions, which was the ability to introduce at trial coerced statements of the suspect. But it nonetheless suffers from a lack of independence, from procedures that are being made up from scratch and don't have the long due process tradition of either the U.S. regular federal courts or even regular courts martial. As a result, trials before these military commissions will continue to lack credibility. The main focus will be the fairness of the trials rather than the seriousness of the crime that the suspects are accused of. In addition, Obama has refused to repudiate the continued use of long-term detention without charge or trial. He's changed the legal basis for that claim. He no longer insists that he can do this just as a matter of executive authority the way Bush did. He now relies on Congress's authorization for the use of military force. But the bottom line is the same. He continues to insist that the U.S. government can arrest somebody any place in the world, far from any recognizable battlefield, claim that they are a combatant in the war against terrorism, and detain them until the end of the war, which, of course, will probably never come in our lifetime or theirs.
V prejšnjih oddajah smo poročali o tem, kako Italija v dogovoru z Gaddafijem s pomočjo Frontexa vrača migrante in begunce nazaj na obale Libije. Centri za tujce, v katere se prebežnike po vrnitvi zapira, slovijo po nečloveških razmerah. Več nevladnih organizacij je dokumentiralo vrsto primerov strašljivih kršitev človekovih pravic. Libija je bila ustaljena migracijska pot iz Afrike na obale Evrope, pred dogovori z Italijo celo uspodbujena strani libijskega voditelja. Statistike kažejo, da je ustaljeno prepričanje, da so migrantje, ki poskušajo doseči obale Evrope, po večini ekonomski migrantje, napačno. Pisarna Visokega komisarjata Združenih narodov za begunce v Rimu je potrdila, da je velik del prebežnikov po zaposlitvi za azil dejansko pridobilo status begunca. Mnogi izmed teh so begunci iz Eritreje in drugih afriških držav. Po spremembi morske migracijske poti iz Libije v Italijo v veliki meri nosijo posledico tudi begunci. Znano je, da je v libijskih centrih za tujce zaprto tudi mnogo eritrejcev, ki so zbežali iz lastne države pred enim izmed najhujših diktatorskih režimov danes. Libija nima obstoječega azilnega zakona, zato je usoda beguncev negotova. Human Rights Watch je v januarju poročal o novih incidentih. Libijske oblasti so dovolile vstop v centre za tujce eritrejskim oblastem, ki so dokumentirale eritrejske ujetnike. Nevladne organizacije opozarjajo mednarodno javnost na posledice vračila beguncev v Eritrejo. Verjetno ni potrebno posebej poudarjati, kaj bi to zanje pomenilo. Nasprotno pa je smiselno ponavljati vedno znova naslednje dejstvo. Zapori, centri, v katere zapirajo ulovljene migrante in begunce, so sofinancirani strani Italije. Obračamo pogled še proti lokalnemu dogajanju. Prvo leto delovanja je novembra lansko leto odkljukala tudi nova slovenska vlada. Februarja 2009 smo v oddaji govorili z generalnim sekretarjem Ministrstva za notranje zadeve Goranom Klemenčičem o planih in potrebnih spremembah na sveže zasedenem delovnem mestu. Omenil je reorganizacijo tedanjega direktorata v dve ločeni enoti in novo ustanovitev direktorata namenjenega migracijam in integraciji. Ena izmed prednostnih nalog naj bi bile spremembe spornega zakona o mednarodni zaščiti, ki je bil sprejet v času prejšnje vlade. Za razliko od sedaj veljavne verzije naj bi izboljšava zakona upoštevala tudi predloge nevladnih organizacij. Tokrat smo o spremembah zakona o mednarodni zaščiti in delovanju direktorata za migracije in integracijo govorili z namestnikom generalne direktorice direktorata za migracije in integracijo Ministrstva za notranje zadeve, magistrom Matjažem Dovžanom.
S tem, ko je bila imenovana oziroma izvoljena nova vlada, so se pač seveda dogodile določene politične spremembe, ki so seveda vplivale na odnos do migranti kot take. Ne. In kot prva zadeva je bila napovedana sprememba zakona o mednarodni zaščiti. Vlada je imenovala projektno skupino. Ta projektna skupina je bila razdeljena na podskupine in v tej projektni skupini so bili poleg predstavnikov različnih resorjev imenovani tudi predstavniki nevladnih organizacij. Ta projektna skupina je nekako končala svojim delom v letu konec leta 2009 in pripravila obsežne spremembe in dopolnitve zakona o mednarodni zaščiti. Ta predlog sprememb in dopolnitev zakona se trenutno tehnično pripravlja za postopek medresorskega usklajevanja. Ko bo to usklajevanje zaključeno, bo seveda zakon poslan na vlado, če ga vlada potrdi, potem tudi v državni zbor v postopek sprejema. Bistvene spremembe zakona gredo v smeri dviga standardov za prosilce za mednarodno zaščito. V zakonu bomo poskušali odpraviti nekatere nedoslednosti, ki so morda vsebinske narave, redakcijske narave, nekatera usklajevanja z mednarodnimi akti še, potem tudi nekaj korekcij procesnih določb, ki bo pripeljalo do tega, da bo položaj prosilcev za mednarodno zaščito še ugodnejši, še bolj transparenten. Bistveno pa je bilo, da se s pripravo tega zakona oziroma sprememb in dopolnitev zakona omogoči civilnemu sektorju, torej predvsem nevladnim organizacijam, da tudi sami aktivno sodelujejo pri delu delovne skupine in s tem sami tvorno kreirajo tudi spremembe in dopolnitve zakona.
Kaj pomenijo spremembe zakona konkretno za prosilce za azil oziroma mednarodno zaščito? Matjaž Dovžan.
Torej poskušali bomo dvigniti standard oziroma raven standardov v postopkih mednarodne zaščite. Če navedem nekaj konkretnih primerov, naprimer višja raven zdravstvenega varstva za mladoletnike, da nadalje širimo obseg brezplačne pravne pomoči v postopkih mednarodne zaščite, nadalje razširjamo definicijo družinskih članov v zakonu, nekateri roki, procesni roki so podaljšani, naprimer iz 3 na 8 dni, kar se tiče uveljavljanja pravnega sredstva. Uvajamo naprimer tudi enkratno denarno pomoč za osebe, ki jim je priznana mednarodna zaščita, torej v obdobju, ko preide oseba iz statusa prosilca za mednarodno zaščito v priznanega begunca in tako dalje. Še bi lahko našteval, mislim, da je kar nekaj takšnih točk, kjer je razvidno povišanje standarda oziroma nivoja.
Glede na to, da je Slovenija v zadnjih letih pridobila sloves negostoljubne države, ki ima izjemno nizak odstotek pozitivno rešenih prošenj za azil, nas je zanimala statistika za preteklo leto. Matjaž Dovžan.
Jaz mislim, da spremembe so se že dogodile oziroma se že kažejo iz naših statističnih podatkov. Če pogledamo samo podatke v letu 2008, kjer je bilo priznanih 4 statusi mednarodne zaščite, v letu 2009 je bilo priznani 20 takšnih statusov. Bistveno pri tem pa je, da se je pa predvsem v zadnjem času, in temu mi pripisujemo tudi, bom rekel, porast v lanskem letu priznanih statusov, da se je struktura prosilcev za mednarodno zaščito spremenila v smislu izvorne države, odkoder prihajajo. In v zadnjem času so ti prosilci prihajajo predvsem iz držav bližnjega vzhoda, tudi Afrike, vzhoda in tako naprej. Torej, izvorne države, kot so bile prej v poprečju oziroma v večini, predvsem v letih 2006, 2007, 2008, to so države Zahodnega Balkana in Balkana širše, nekako sedaj izginjajo in temu mi pripisujemo tudi spremembo v samih odločitvah.
Za konec današnje oddaje predstavljamo aktualen projekt slovenske filantropije, ki je sicer aktivna na področju psihosocialne pomoči beguncem in osredotočena na pomoč mladostnikom brez spremstva. Tokrat je razširila polje delovanja. Na podlagi ankete, ki jo je leta 2006 izvedel Zavod Republike Slovenije za šolstvo, je bilo ugotovljeno, da v Slovenijo prihaja vse več otrok migrantov, ki pa se pri vključevanju v šolo soočajo z vrsto težav. Marina Uzelac iz Slovenske filantropije nam je takole predstavila projekt Mladim migrantom prilagojeni programi integracije.
Naš center je v preteklosti dejansko bolj usredotočen na pomoč beguncem, ko smo opazili, da je vedno več mladih migrantov, torej otrok, ki pridejo sam z družinami in se vključujejo na šolski sistem, da se srečujejo s podobnimi problemi, kot recimo otroci begunci. Ne? In na podlagi teh naših izkušenj smo pač ugotovili na podlagi pogovoru s temi otroki smo ugotovili, da je zelo velik diskriminacija in tudi programi, ki so v šoli namenjeni tem otrokom, niso pač prilagojeni njihovim potrebam in njihova obravnava pač ni prilagojena temu, kar oni rabijo. In zaradi tega smo pač prišli na idejo, da bi bilo z ene strani pomembno razvijati tako programe pomoči za te mlade migrante, hkrati pa spodbujati neko prostovoljno delo na tem področju, torej da bi vsak otrok dobil tudi nekega prostovoljca, ki bi mu pač pomagal pri lažji integraciji, z druge strani pa nekako vplivati znotraj šole s temi delavnicami za strokovne delavce in za učitelje pri povečanju te senzibilizacije za potrebno obravnavo teh otrok.
Slovenska filantropija je pripravila tudi analizo stanja na področju vključevanja učencev in dijakov z migrantskim ozadjem v slovenski izobraževalni sistem. Duši Kumar, ki je sodelovala pri pripravi analize, nam je nakratko predstavila rezultate.
Vprašalnike smo razdelili na srednje in osnovne šole v petih mestih, kjer smo predvidevali, da gre za nekak največji odstotek migrantov. In pa v Mursko Soboto. Analiza je pokazala, da v bistvu kar 90% vseh šol, ki so nam vrnile vprašalnik, navaja potrebo po posebni obravnavi učencev oziroma dijakov z migrantskim ozadjem. V okviru česa pa predvsem navajajo pomoč pri učenju slovenskega jezika in seveda posledično zato tudi pomoč pri razumevanju učne snovi. Analiza je pokazala, da v bistvu kar 90% vseh šol, ki so nam vrnile vprašalnik, navaja potrebo po posebni obravnavi učencev oziroma dijakov z migrantskim ozadjem. V okviru česa pa predvsem navajajo pomoč pri učenju slovenskega jezika in seveda posledično zato tudi pomoč pri razumevanju učne snovi. Problem tega slovenskega jezika je namreč v tem, da slovenska zakonodaja v bistvu predpisuje za te otroke 35 ur dodatne pomoči v šoli. Seveda je to premalo. Največkrat pa v bistvu pol praksa še celo tako pokaže, da teh 35 ur ni dodeljenih enemu otroku, ampak v bistvu vsem otrokom z migrantskim ozadjem, kar je jasno premalo.
Thank you. Največ otrok migrantov prihaja iz področja bivših republik Jugoslavije, iz Albanije, Kitajske, nekaj pa tudi iz azijskih in afriških držav. Oddajo je pripravila Romana z ob asistenci Božota in Roka. En azil prosim pa bo znova z vami čez mesec dni.
En azil prosim.
A prihajajo? Ja, jaz nisem še nobenih videl, tako da ne morem reči, zakaj prihajajo.
Ja, odvisno od kod, ne? Eni iz ekonomskih, eni iz političnih, eni ne vem, iz Angola, zato ko so jim starše pobili in so pol pobegnili, ker bi še njih.
In če bi čital, če bi bil to tak problem, da bi jih bilo 100 ali pa celo več, bi se sigurno o tem kaj vedel, ne, ne pa da samo vedel, veste to.
Slovenska filantropija je leta 2001, ko se je pokazala potreba potem skupaj z UNHCR-om in Centrom za socialno delo sklenila dogovor.
Vsak zadnji ponedeljek v mesecu ob 8 zvečer na valovih Radia Študent prisluhnite oddaji En azil prosim